From theheart.org radio, you are listening to Click and Rub with Drs. Eric Topol and Paul Tierstein.
Well, hello, this is Eric Topol, and I'm here with my colleague Paul Tierstein for the next edition of Click and Rub. And today we're going to be working on the topic of why is medicine so resistant to change? Over the years, we've watched so many things that have tested whether or not the medical community, particularly the cardiovascular community, can adapt to new findings, change of practice, and consistently seeing how it's not impossible, but it takes what seemingly forever to get something to change in our practice. So maybe get, Paul, your thoughts about what is the basic lesion here?
I don't know what the basic lesion is. I've always felt that I've been pretty open to change, but I agree with you. It often feels like it's pulling teeth to get a lot of other doctors to change, particularly in front of the data. And, you know, we've talked about this a number of times now, and it seems like we're supposed to say everything should be completely data-driven, but unfortunately we don't always have the data, and we don't always have high-quality data available to take care of our patients. So I was thinking about something that relates to this, which is this problem of stent thrombosis that had everyone all up in arms for the last 3 years. And, you know, everyone worries about stent thrombosis and talks about it, but, you know, they don't do much about it. You know, why aren't people doing more about stent thrombosis, the absence of hard data?
Well, this is a matter of potentially life and death.
It's a huge problem, and yet, for example, we have a machine made by Acumetrics, the Verify Now machine, and, you know, I should say I have absolutely no interest, no conflicts regarding Acumetrics. I have no stock, no interest whatsoever, but I don't understand why everyone's not checking their patient's platelet function after taking clopidogrel. You know, if a patient receives stents and is on clopidogrel, I think you ought to check their platelet function. Now, we're doing a big trial, Gravitas. It's a randomized placebo-controlled trial to prove that this is important and to prove that we can change things, that we can change outcomes if we double up the clopidogrel dosage in these patients. And we haven't proved it yet. We're 70% through enrolling patients. But, you know, we don't have the data yet. So if I wasn't doing the trial, I'd want to check my patient's platelets the day after I stent them to make sure that they're inhibited by clopidogrel. And if they're not, I'm going to want to do something about it. And I've become pretty insistent about this. I try to keep my finger on the pulse of what's going on in interventional cardiology, and I kind of run around the country and I give talks and I talk to doctors. They don't know what I'm talking about when I mention.
Well, and it's a similar parallel situation in the genotyping of the cytochrome, where you could get some enhanced knowledge about the individual patient and potentially make a difference. But, you know, I saw this back. I remember with TPA, where we had already in 1984, we were showing how TPA opened up arteries more than streptokinase. And in 1987, it was approved by the FDA. And it wasn't in popular use until 1993, even though it saved more lives, it dissolved the clots faster, and all the other things that you'd want in a fibrolytic agent. Years to do this. Now, one of the things just as a student of this resistance phenomenon. Now, we're not talking about clopidogrel resistance. We're talking about physician resistance, yes.
I love it.
And I don't know if it's in the genomic basis of physicians, but, you know, let me just get your thoughts. The direct-to-consumer model of pharmaceutical advertising, this is a workaround plan. This is a bypass, right? They couldn't get the physicians to change. They had 800,000 docs in the U.S. and 100,000, you know, sales reps detailing docs. They couldn't get them to change. Put advertisements on TV, and that's how they get the drug sold. What does that tell us about the medical community?
First of all, I actually support direct-to-consumer advertising, even though it's very, very controversial. I know it's very bad to support that these days.
Oh, I got to hear about this. I didn't know that.
Because, you know, whenever a patient brings it up to my attention, you know, they ask me a question, they read about it somewhere, and they saw an ad, you know, I think that's okay. It's annoying. But I think, well, you know, that's probably pretty good because the patient's aware and alert and trying to do the best thing they can for themselves.
Is that for Viagra or Cialis?
Yeah, almost.
Levitra? No, I mean, really, this is crazy.
Well, I don't have a problem with the patients trying to influence their doctors. I think, you know, if you're a good doctor, you're gonna know the literature, you know the facts, and you know your patients, and you'll be able to deal with that. I don't have a problem with that at all.
What if it was a new medicine that was just approved? And it wasn't really tested in the mass population. Or what if it was just a medicine for lifestyle?
Okay,
like,
so,
you know, ED.
So what's wrong with your patient coming to you and saying, look, you know, I saw an ad about this new medicine that hasn't been approved, that was just approved. You know, I know you may not have any experience with it, but how come you're not giving this to me? And you, as a physician, are forced then to learn about that medicine and answer the patient's question. I don't think there's a problem with it. I mean, obviously, there's lots of problems with it and that, in, you know, increased medical costs, et cetera, but I don't have a problem with the patients asking me that. I think it's fine.
Well, I don't have a problem with it, but I guess we don't want to just debate the DTC advertising model so much as why did this become so important to the pharma industry?
Because the physicians weren't doing it. But isn't that partly the fault of the thought leaders and the physicians doing the trials and talking about the new therapies and that they've been – I mean, for example, take your TPA story. Weren't there a lot of anti-TPA folks out there spreading the anti-TPA? So then the doctors get the doctors trying to take care of their patient, they get mixed messages.
Well, it was an easy target because it costs more than streptokinase. And so, sure, I mean, there was something bad about it because it was expensive. Even though I was dealing with heart attack reperfusion, and it was before the days where angioplasty, you know, was commonplace for acute MI.
Right. I had two patients in the last 3 months who had stent thromboses. They were late stent thromboses, and they were both on clopidogrel. And we checked their platelet reactivity units with the Verify Now, and both of them were vastly under-inhibited. And this is, you know, these are anecdotes, but I the data really supports this correlation, and I just don't know why more people aren't doing it, and I don't understand it. I don't blame the community physicians. I really blame the doctors who are out there talking about how to take care of patients. There's so much.
Well, you know what? It's really timely you mention that. In the European Heart Journal, you know, Gilles Montalesco, he has, with a couple of colleagues, this editorial called Stent Thrombosis, Who's Guilty?
Yeah, good.
And the answer is doctors are guilty. How do you like that?
Well, I mean, there is no we can do. I mean, maybe we can't get it to zero, but we, you know, it runs on the order of 1% a year. We can get it down to 0.5%, and probably even less than that on, you know, years 2 and 3 and 4. And for example, I mean, how do you deal with the recent data from the OASIS 7 trial? I don't think you and I totally agree on this. The compare arm of that, looking at PCI patients. Do you think that just plain forgetting about testing them but giving them 150 milligrams of clopidogrel for the first week, you think that makes some sense based on that data?
No, I think that's unacceptable given the many other choices that you have. I mean, I think that to give everybody an overdose, I mean, the majority of people have a normal responsiveness as predicted by genotype or 5 platelet function testing. So why would you give all these people double a dose and expose them to unnecessary hazard? So I don't agree. I think, you know, the fact is this can be guided. But this is where this whole evidence-based thing has gone crazy. Well, how much evidence do you need when, you know, the first reaction about the genotyping when I posted that on the heart.org was several comments about, well, you need randomized trials. How do you do a randomized trial when there's 10 different possible strategies? Whether it's with different drugs, higher doses of the drug, platelet function testing, multiple times of platelet function testing, you know, of 1 week of high dose clopidogrel, several weeks, months. How can you do a randomized trial and that doesn't even take into account bleeding risk of the patient, cardiac function, coronary anatomy, all these things?
I don't totally agree with you. Yes, but I don't totally agree with you. I think you can do a randomized trial. I think you simply pick. You pick the endpoints and the strategies that makes the most sense to you and do the randomized trial. But that shouldn't stop you from taking patients who aren't in a randomized trial and trying to do something with the information that you've got.
I disagree, Paul, because holding everything hostage to a randomized trial, which is contrived, you know, selecting out one strategy among many, whether it's the drug or the platelet function, and this is just an example. We're just talking about a prototype here. That doesn't extrapolate to the real practice of medicine. This is the problem, I think.
You can't just toss randomized trials away, obviously.
No, I'm a big advocate of randomized trials when they're appropriately framed. But when you there is something about treating patients on the best evidence available and then particularizing that to the patient at hand. And I don't think we do enough of that, and we don't acknowledge that that's actually important. That gets back to your original point, which is why aren't we not taking care of patients the best we can, even when at times we're waiting for data from a trial.
Exactly. Well, that's really the point I'm trying to make. There's things we can do. If you don't have Verify Now, you can double the patient's dose of clopidogrel for the first week.
How do you know just a week is right? How do you know it's not a month?
Well, because most of the events seem to occur in the first week. But I think that you should measure the platelet function. That would be the ideal. You're not going to talk me out of that or into that. Okay. Well, let me ask you about genotyping. I got to pin you down on something. This genotyping. You've been very forward here, and you've matter of fact, we're all running around here at Scripps Clinic, measuring our patients' CYP2C19 loss of function gene. We're crazy about it now, and a lot of attention, a lot of press. Explain to me again in front of everyone why it's more important than just measuring the platelet function. Isn't phenotype more important than genotype?
No, because the phenotype here, if you're talking about platelet function testing, that's at that particular moment in time. You get, you know, with one different way to measure it, you get a result that no one knows exactly, you know, how to interpret that result, and it's dynamic. The genotype is the germline DNA. It doesn't change. It tells you whether or not the drug clopidogrel is going to be metabolized normally or whether it's going to be, you know, a problem in changing that drug to its active form.
Right.
So it's a big difference. And in many ways, they're complementary in terms of the information they provide. But, you know, the point is that if you had the actual cost of doing a single genotype, the cost of doing it is pennies, and it's a valuable information. It is not the only determinant of platelet responsiveness to this very frequently used drug, clopidogrel, but it's the most important determinant. In fact, that's through a genome-wide study. More than half of the genomic variants across man of clopidogrel response is accounted for by one gene. Now, that's a big deal when you think of there's 3 billion base pairs and there's 23,000 genes, that one gene is accounting for more than half of all the response of the drug across humankind. So it is an important thing to assay, and it should be routine. And, you know, I don't know that we need randomized trials for that.
I agree with you, and I think they are complementary. Now, what about how are we going to get it out? How are we going to get that test out and make that available? Because that's a little bit, I think, more of a challenge right now, isn't it?
So the genotyping?
Yeah, if you're a doctor,
eventually, you know, if people get genome-wide scans, eventually someday it'll just be in their, you know, in their iPhone or app for their smartphone, and just say, you know, doc, don't give me this dose because I can't metabolize that drug, and it'll be like the consumer-driven story here because it's not getting absorbed, it's not getting uptake, in the medical community. But right for now, we need to have really inexpensive, high-quality genotyping available And it isn't just this drug. It's across lots of different drugs. You know, more than 25% of drugs, prescription drugs, have pharmacogenetic literature that's, you know, quite impressive. That's a lot. And we don't take that into account in our daily practice of medicine.
Yeah, well, that'll be the future. One other thing, Prasugrel. It's now been available for a few months, and we're starting to use it. I've never asked you, what kind of patients are you switching to Prasugrel or starting Prasugrel on?
Well, I think if you have a patient who has a problem metabolizing clopidogrel, that's proven, then it's time to think about it. And then that's where you have to factor in, is the patient have a significant bleeding risk? Whether because of prior bleeding complications or their frailty index.
Age.
Yeah, exactly. So I think in somebody who's got serious coronary anatomy story, I mean, I remember, you know, we were a patient with Matthew last week who had left main and was relatively young and, you know, stented and, you know, and also had a loss of function allele. I think that's a perfect patient to use Prasugrel right now. So I think, you know, that's the tailoring. What has ever happened to the art of medicine?
Well, that's what really we're talking about, and I think that this is there's really been an explosion in the last year of things we can do for patients to reduce the risk of thrombosis, and that includes measuring their platelet function, measuring their genotype, putting some patients on Prasugrel. And also some patients on a double dose of clopidogrel. It's sort of a lot of things to choose from. The menu's gotten really extensive. And
that's why I don't think we can do a randomized trial. But no, I'm sorry. Just putting in my bid on that again. But anyway, go ahead.
Well, I think Gravitas is a randomized trial. We picked a couple of things to look at in Gravitas, and I think it'll be important.
No, I think it's great. Then we're going to get genotyping in that trial, and that'll help sort a lot of this stuff out. But just go back to that key point.
The reason I wanted to bring this up and do a click on rub on this is just try to get that point out. And whenever I give talks now, I try to make this point that the individual doctor taking care of a patient has a lot to choose from this year that we didn't have a few years ago. And they really got to think about each individual patient and try to do what you can to reduce the risk of thrombosis. And I think we're improving. I think we're getting better.
Okay, but now let's go back to the fundamental question, okay? We can't change medical practice even when there is hard evidence from randomized trials. And now we're talking about changing medical practice without hard evidence from, you know, multiple rigorously conducted randomized trials. So what's going on here, and how is this ever going to change?
Yeah, I think that you can change it, Eric. You can change it. I think you need to talk more about it.
I give you one example when medicine was changed drastically, mm-hmm. of a whole new model, okay? Remember this drug, nisiretide, Natricor?
Yeah.
Okay. Remember there was this thing called the heart failure tune-ups?
Yeah.
And you could just put a patient, outpatient, they'd had heart failure, you would bring them in once a week, and you just give them an IV drip, and then you're charging it as a chemotherapy. The physician made a lot of money. The company selling the drug made a lot of money, even though there was absolutely no evidence, okay? Now, that has been abandoned because it was, you know, a major...
That was data-driven, wasn't it?
There were no data. No data whatsoever.
Didn't data drive the abandonment of those...
Oh, the
HF
lack of data. But
yeah.
what I'm saying is the uptake of that practice was driven for financial incentives, both for the physicians and the company, but it was never driven. It had no evidence. So is that the only way you can change medical practice, either by a direct-to-consumer model or by paying physicians to do something that has no evidence? Well, that's the only example I ever saw where there was a feeding frenzy of heart failure tune-up clinics cropping up everywhere around the country.
Maybe that was contaminated by the economic incentives, and because what you're really saying there is that physicians took this idea of giving nisiretide for CHF patients once a week, and they adopted it without evidence, and it turned out to be wrong.
Right.
So
right.
It'd be a little bit like, you know, here I am telling everyone they've got to measure platelet function and do something about it, and then the Gravitas could come out and improve that. Doesn't work at all. Okay. So,
yeah. Okay. But what if I started a physician clunker program? Okay. And I would pay every physician for every stent they put in that they did exquisite monitoring. of their patients to prevent stent thrombosis. Don't you think it would become wide-scale incorporated into practice?
Well, we can't do that. We can't.
I know we can't.
That's not going to work. It's not there's enough of incentive to minimize stent thrombosis and heart attack and death. Should be enough of an incentive.
It should be enough. There you go. But I don't think it is. And I just watched it too many times that it's really hard to affect a change in the medical community.
So pay for performance. You think that's going to do anything?
I don't know. It's sobering. It's sobering. I thought you would have the solution.
Pay for performance to me just seems like, you're going to get paid what you get paid now or probably less, provided you have documentation of things you're probably going to do anyway. So it's probably going to be pay for documentation.
I got one for you. What if you set it up whereby when you put in a stent, you get 80% of your fee up front, and you get a 20% bonus at the end of a year if the patient has not had a stent thrombosis?
If that impacted medical care, that would be a sorry state, wouldn't it? I mean, the idea.
I'm trying to be creative here.
I just can't imagine that physicians would react to that. I think that physicians need to see other doctors doing it. They need to hear about it. They need to hear. It needs to be something that we talk about. I don't think
we're talking about these options enough. Yeah, as we learn, the best way they get affected is by having patients drive it, saying, I want the prescription for such and such, because that changes practice more than anything else we know, much more than randomized trials. But we need new ways to transform medicine.
You are for direct-to-consumer, right?
No.
You want to change physicians' behavior, and you just said that that's the best way to change it. So that sounds like you are for it.
I'm for the consumer-driven healthcare, but I'm not for drugs that are for lifestyle. If they're life-saving drugs, I might think about it. And after they've been proven in the mass population to be very safe, that's a different story. But
you'd be okay for Prasugrel for some direct-to-consumer on Prasugrel because it does seem to reduce stent thrombosis. You'd be all right on with that then?
I don't know. It has a black box for bleeding on it. I'm not sure that's the best example.
All right.
But maybe something that actually did had a life-saving, prevented heart attacks, prevented stroke, something like that. Maybe I would consider it. But the consumer-driven movement is what I'm referring to as a good thing, because it changes medicine. We've learned from that experience, okay? But I don't know that we have applied that in terms of we how many different paths, successful routes are there to change practice. That's only one example.
If I had the drug that you just described, I'd be thrilled. I'd be thrilled. I'd promote it any way possible.
This has been an interesting discussion. I think we've hit on a number of things I never even thought we would get into today. But I hope that the listeners can appreciate that this is a real challenge. That is, whether you have evidence, whether you don't have evidence, that actually actualizing a change in practice is really, really tough. And whether it's because, physicians are busy and distracted or reluctant to change because they're very conservative overall, many different things, I guess. But, this is a challenge going forward as we try to rev up for a better model of healthcare.
The more we talk about it, just like this, even though we came to absolutely no conclusions whatsoever, I think the better it is, and I'd like to see more physicians talking about things that they can do to help their patients that maybe aren't fully vetted yet in randomized trials.
Yeah, that's a good concluding remark there, Paul. Well, thanks a lot. Good to chat with you on this topic.
Nice talking to you.
Okay.
All right. Bye.
You've been listening to Click and Rub with Drs. Eric Topol and Paul Tierstein on the Heart.org radio, sharing ideas and opinions with the cardiology community worldwide. Find out more on the Heart.org.